This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Zek. Last week, we observed World Refugee Day on June 20th, and with more than 150,000 refugees and asylum seekers currently in Malaysia, is it high time Malaysia ratify, finally, the United Nations 1951 Refugee Convention and reform our immigration policy? Lawyer Renuka Balasubramaniam wrote in an op-ed recently for Malaysia Kini that we should start by allowing refugees to work legally in this country. She's joining me now from Melbourne, where she is pursuing a PhD at the Melbourne Law School. Renuka, welcome, and thank you very much for doing this.
Hi, Antik. Thank you very much for having me.
In essence, you're saying that we should be hiring or turning to refugees as an untapped potential in our country and rely on them instead of importing more foreign workers. Why do you think this is a good idea?
Okay, so I think just to clarify, the numbers of refugees in Malaysia are nowhere close to the numbers of migrant workers that we have in Malaysia right now. I think from last count, I recall Nepali workers alone number something like 750,000. And that doesn't count Indonesians. The numbers are very, very small comparatively. So in no way am I saying that we need to stop bringing in migrant workers and rely entirely on refugees. All I'm saying in my article is that we already have a thriving labor, foreign labor recruitment policy. That process can quite easily be extended to refugees. That's what I'm saying in my op-ed.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think we're not doing that at the moment?
So part of the problem is, I believe, that our policymakers have not taken the time to understand the issues in a comprehensive way. And I believe that part of the reason for that is because immigration and certainly refugees are not a political card that any party wants to play. Because the discussion always comes back to, why are you talking about these non-citizens? We have many local issues that need your urgent attention. So it's not a politically popular topic, and that's probably the reason why it's just never been on the agenda in a big way. Mm-hmm. If anything, in Malaysia, the whole issue of protecting refugees usually arises as a result of international proposals or pressure, or it just happens to be politically convenient at some given time to make some statements about the granting protection to refugees. Yes, of course, there have been times in our past when our leaders have responded to some crisis. I remember Tun Mahathir proposed that we host refugees from Bosnia-Herzegovina. There were times when we hosted refugees from the Philippines, from Mindanao, Muslim refugees from Mindanao, and even recently from Syria. Those were statements in response to crisis that was going on. Mm-hmm. So yes, there have been such occasions, but for the most part, it's because of international pressure and the presence of UNHCR in Malaysia.
Yeah. What would be your response to politicians who need that capital for them to see that this is something worthwhile pursuing other than a major conflict erupting? How do we move the needle in this debate to get a government to act by recognizing the Refugee Convention or by even granting refugees the legal right to work?
Yeah. So I tend to look at the policy making and even lawmaking as a reflection of the current demands or needs of any society. As far as Malaysia is concerned, if we look at our track record from as far back as the 70s, we know that almost every other country in the world, we, insofar as refugees are concerned, we respond as and when the need arises. And that is, I think, a very, very natural thing. Now, all I'm proposing to our lawmakers is, given that we have a history of responding as and when necessary to refugees, the need for protection by refugees. What's stopping us from creating a law, enacting law that allows for government to do this in an orderly fashion? We've been doing it for 40 years without such a law. What's wrong with enacting it in a formal way so that when such situations do arise, we have already in place plans for what they're supposed to do when they do get here? So, for example, what I've proposed in the op-ed was we already have a process by which we issue work permits to migrant workers, and those work permits are usually, in some cases, for durations of 2 years, some cases durations of 5 years. We've already got that process up and running. According to our Immigration Act, for example, the Director General for Immigration has the power to issue permits of entry into Malaysia to non-citizens on three main grounds. They are for work, for studies, or as a spouse. So we all the Act already provides for this. Now, if we were to create, for example, enact a Refugee Act, we might want to, in that Act, prescribe the circumstances upon which we, as you know, or the authority within Malaysian government that would decide if refugee status is should be granted to specific groups. Currently, UNHCR is doing that, but there's absolutely no reason why. In fact, it is recommended that each state carries out that that determination. Under what circumstances and to whom or which groups is such protection going to be granted? And upon being granted, what rights are they going to be accorded? So, of course, in the more developed countries, they have the capacity to give a lot more. They provide maybe a monthly stipend. They provide maybe a housing allowance. They provide free education, maybe healthcare. They cover their hospital and insurance, all of those things. It doesn't mean that Malaysia would have to do that. This is an example. So we already have a labor, foreign worker program. There is no reason why that in its self-contained way cannot be applied to refugees.
Before we even get to something like a Refugee Act, I think the opposition to granting refugees who are currently here the right to work legally, critics are saying this will open the floodgates where it will lead to more refugees wanting to come to Malaysia and settle down here indefinitely. What would you say to those criticisms?
So I think the benefit of enacting, for example, a Refugee Act is that it provides clarity for as regards, firstly, who is going to get refugee status. Just because someone enters the country claiming refugee status doesn't make them automatically a refugee. An assessment needs to be conducted. Just in the same way that we have lots of workers from the neighboring countries coming into Malaysia in the hopes of being able to seek work, coming in on tourist visas in the hopes of or being deluded into thinking that they can come in and later get work or work permits. People come into the country for a variety of reasons. With a variety of hopes, but it doesn't mean that they're going to get it, right? So in the same way, the same rule, I would say, applies to even asylum claims. Just because if they can't come in as refugees and claim status, they can certainly come in as tourists. What's stopping them? And that is already going on. This is the main point. We already have refugees in the country. We already have a floodgates problem going on. Enacting a new piece of legislation which is clarifying the circumstances in which people get refugee status is not going to, I believe, make a big difference or cause the floodgates to open up. I don't think that argument makes any sense.
Yeah, I think various commentators have pointed out that we as a country has been very kind in receiving country, just we haven't gotten our act together to go the extra step in formalizing the process of receiving refugees.
That's right. Yeah. What's also important is that we need to be able to say with clarity exactly how many refugees we are hosting. Just, I think it was yesterday, the Minister for Human Resources, in one of his speeches, talked about how to date, since the Pakatan Harapan government came into power, they have been trying to find records of exactly how many migrant workers do we have in this country, and then unable to find any such records because there has just not been any proper system of keeping these records. So which do you think is a greater threat to Malaysian security? Knowing who's in our country and what are the circumstances they're going to be here and for how long, or just hiding our heads in the sand and pretending that everything is okay?
I'm speaking today to lawyer Renuka Bala Subrabaniam about how we treat refugees in Malaysia. Up next, I'll ask her whether there are countries around the world who has done a good job of integrating refugees that we can emulate here in Malaysia. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antik. With me today is lawyer Renuka Bala Subrabaniam. We're discussing an article she wrote in conjunction with World Refugee Day for Malaysia Kini. In it, she discussed the untapped potential for refugees in Malaysia. It's one of the promises made by Pakatan Harapan if they came to power. They would initiate the process and eventually ratify the UN 1951 Refugee Convention. What would that entail? What would the sort of the immediate implication of us being a party to this convention?
So the thing is, one of the very interesting things my studies have revealed about the Malaysia's track record insofar as the ratification of international conventions is that the ratification has not actually produced extraordinary results. So I'll give as an example, for example, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. We only enacted the Child Act in something like 10 years after we signed that convention. The Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. We signed that and it's nearly 20 years and we still haven't enacted any laws pertaining to gender equity. The Convention Against Corruption, oh my God, we signed that in 2003. What really are we doing in relation to corruption given the new discoveries we have found out? So I have not actually a lot of faith in convention ratification or accession because it is, for the greater part, a symbolic act. In the West, many countries show their support to the UN by ratifying conventions to promote new conventions that are developed by the UN. I don't think we are in a space where we are keen to do those kinds of things. On the other hand, we have, in many situations, developed strong laws without signing on to conventions. So, for example, we have not signed on to the Convention on Civil and Political Rights, but we have local laws which protect civil and political rights. So, for example, our Criminal Procedure Code requires that upon arrest, detainees need to be produced before a magistrate. This is a civil right that you are brought before the law. We didn't sign a convention in order to do that, and yet we enacted very consistently. So I would be more interested in seeing Malaysia go in that direction where you actually walk the talk rather than just talk the talk. And I find that as far as Malaysia's track record has gone, we tend to, at least insofar as international law and signing of international conventions, it's just a lot of talk and very little walk, which it doesn't actually bode well for the rule of law.
So something that is good to have, but not necessarily...
Not essential, yeah. I don't think it's essential.
So we shouldn't be preoccupied with this promise.
Precisely. On the other hand, given that we've already made so much headway with the way we are granting humanitarian protection to specific groups as and when the need arises, I think That says a lot. We are not talkers, we're doers. So very, very, certainly very admirable, much more than many of the richer countries in the world are doing, with so much of a smaller budget. And I think this is one of the things that's great about Malaysia. We do what we can within our means, and that's good enough. There's no need to compare that with, you know, other countries which are comparatively richer, if you like.
Mm-hmm. And do we have the means or resources to absorb those who are already here? Do we have the capacity to maybe even take on more?
So I think, as I said in my op-ed, I only see the formalizing of our protection system as a means by which growth will be enhanced, economic growth can be enhanced, and corruption can be reduced. And those are the two main points that I make. Mm-hmm. And why do I say that? Currently, because of the lack of formalization, refugees are often put in situations where just about everybody's trying to hit them up for a bribe, some kind of extortion, using their, you know, somewhat irregular status to sort of impose threats on them and try to basically extort a variety of services or goods or whatever from them. It can be from your regular cop on the street who's just trying to give him trouble to get $50. So why should all of that money go into the black market when it could legitimately go into, for example, taxes or the payment of a work permit or into, for example, healthcare? Why shouldn't their labor contribute to our economic growth? Why shouldn't new businesses be created delivering services to these groups and others like them? So all of these, I think, are catalysts for economic growth. And we are ignoring these opportunities by keeping this entire segment of people in a marginalized space.
Yeah. I think some of the opposition to this idea also stems from the anxiety that an influx of refugee would radically change the ethnic composition or demographics of a town, district, or our country. And this is an anxiety that is shared around the world currently. And what do you say to that? Is this fear or concern warranted, unwarranted?
Yes, it's a fact that in every society, whenever there is an influx of a new culture or a new ethnic group, xenophobia, you know, kicks in. And to those who haven't been reassured maybe by their governments that, you know, positive things are going to come out of this and do not, you know, be so afraid of the changes, bad things have happened. People do react very badly and, you know, it causes social conflict. Cultural differences are hard to deal with. We've seen a lot of that in Europe. So I think in that place, politicians and the state itself has a big role to play in managing expectations of both the incoming communities as well as the outgoing communities. And there is hardly anything of the sort going on in Malaysia. In fact, unfortunately, in the past, with the past government, we have very xenophobic, racist comments from our own politicians about communities that we have formally let into the country, even in relation to migrant workers. So to me, that's a bit schizophrenic. You make this decision that you need foreign workers, you need them to work in the country, and yet you want to create this culture of fear about them and all the changes they're going to introduce to your society. So I find that very dysfunctional. I think, as I was saying, the state has an important role to play in managing expectations, ensuring that there's no conflict. And a lot of this can be achieved purely by communication. As for the fear that a change in policy or the enactment of legislation is going to introduce a mass influx, I say that is already happening. That has already happened. Any government official who thinks that 20 years of having migrant workers in Malaysia hasn't resulted in a mix or new introductions into our ethnic composition is totally deluded. Just because we have laws or conditions in work permits that say you're not allowed to get married when you come to work in Malaysia doesn't mean that people are not forming relationships and having children. And we know that there are huge groups of stateless people in East Malaysia, for example, with its porous borders with Indonesia. We know that migrant workers have come across who are, they are married, they are settling here, and that there are huge communities of stateless people in Sabah and Sarawak. So we're, I think, being very short-sighted if we imagine that that's not already happening.
Yeah.
And what I'm proposing in my op-ed is that we really take inventory of what's going on here and provide solutions for all the variations of immigration that are occurring in Malaysia outside the three main groups that are provided in under our Act, which is student, employee, and spouse. I think we need to start thinking about all the other different categories or regularizing, making provision for these other categories that do come up.
Yeah, I think one difference as well between why Malaysians are more accepting towards migrant workers compared to refugees is I suppose the expectation that refugees would be granted citizenship eventually, and so there's some permanence to that. If we take recognizing the rights of refugees to its logical conclusion, is that not the eventual solution that they should be provided citizenship? And this, of course, goes to another very hot debate in Malaysia, and who gets to be called a Malaysian, isn't it?
Yeah. No, but I also think that there is a simpler solution to that. And that is that if we look at UNHCR's track record, UNHCR itself proposes three types of solutions for refugees. They are resettlement, integration, local integration, and repatriation. Now, there's no saying that any country has to pick one of the three. Okay, so there's no international law or anything, nothing that says that, for example, if Malaysia decided to enact a Refugee Act, it has to grant permanent residence to all those that it grants protection to. It could very well say we are prepared to host them temporarily for 5 years, as we do with our migrant workers, until the situation improves for them in their home country or until they get resettled. It's very well within our means and certainly legal for Malaysia to enact legislation of that sort. Often, as we saw in many of the cases in relation to Bosnians and Syrians, and even some Sri Lankans, we know that as soon as things settled down, they did want to go back. So, but what exactly is humanitarian protection? It is extending a safe space to those in need for the time that they need it. And that's the reason I think that it doesn't necessarily need to mean citizenship, although that is certainly an option if, all the other factors align. So I think a key point that I'm making in my op-ed is that many of these questions are up for debate. There will always be opposing views. But ultimately, our policymakers need to make that decision for us. They need to be informed by what civil society and the public thinks. And all of this can only come to play when such a decision is made. So, for example, if they start taking in consultations from the various groups and, it's in the media and everything is open to debate, ultimately, the decision will be made. Who do we grant protection to? For how long? What are they meant to? What kind of rights are we going to grant them while they're here? those are discussions that need to be had, and those discussions need to be formalized in legislation. I think after that, it's also subject to change if it's found to not be working out. I think on the whole, that alternative is way better than what we have right now. Mm.
Being more nimble with how we deal with immigration.
Yeah. Mm. Part of the biggest problems with the way immigration has been handled up to now is that there's way too much executive discretion. There has been way too much executive discretion. There's no certainty. And unfortunately, the government too is subject to the rule of law. It isn't just subjects. So anything the government does needs to be authorized by law. Right. So technically, if you look at it right now, the way we're doing humanitarian protection, there is no law that authorizes us to host refugees. That was just done by the administrative discretion of the minister. And I think anyone would be well within their right to question that.
You say too much discretion in the executive is not necessarily a good thing, but doesn't that also allow a lot of wiggle room in terms of being able to act quickly in some of the recommendations that you are giving in terms of policy decisions?
True, you have wiggle room provided that it is within some existing scope of your authorization. On the other hand, for example, we have the Immigration Act, which says that the minister cannot take decisions that are contrary to the provisions of this Act. So if the Act says you can only enter Malaysia if you have a student, employment or spouse pass, and here you are with neither of those three, the Act says very clearly that you need to be deported.
Right.
So the minister's decision to allow refugees, as benevolent and humanitarian as it is unfortunately, there's no legal basis for it.
Right, okay. And so you're suggesting that we reform our Immigration Act as well?
It definitely needs to at least make provision for the right of the Director General to also extend passes on humanitarian grounds.
Right. Are there countries who have done a good job in terms of providing humanitarian protection that we can emulate here? And if there is one, who can we look to?
So, unfortunately, the vast majority of developing countries are kind of doing protection the way we are.
On an ad hoc basis.
Without any legislation or an administrative basis and, you know, no clear rights for the refugees. It's kind of, you know, you're just here because it's better than where you came from. And that's about it.
Right.
So I think India is in pretty much the same situation. The Philippines and Indonesia, I know, have signed on to the convention, but substantively, I'm not sure it's any better than what we have to offer. So, and then, of course, the developing countries who have a tremendous budget with which they do protection. So I'm not even sure it's fair to compare that with those countries with developing countries. But ideally, I'd say, if you decide, and bear in mind that many of the developing countries take on refugees on the basis of resettlement. So, for example, Malaysia was the largest resettling country for many years because the U.S. had a resettlement program with Malaysia, and the vast number, a large number of refugees from Malaysia were being resettled to the U.S. on a permanent basis. Some argue that that might even have been a pull factor on its own. So I'm thinking that ideally, for whatever period that refugees are being hosted in any country, the right to work is critical, and legislation that authorizes them to be able to work, for children to be able to get education, for women to be able to access services that they need to ensure their own equality. Those basic rights are need to be provided to them by law. They should be able to access justice when they need it, either justice or equality.
This is an issue that you clearly care a lot about, and you've spent a lot of your career working on it as well. Last week was World Refugee Day. I'm a bit late to cover this, but and we don't talk about this issue enough as well in the media. For someone who's listening right now and wondering why should they care about refugees, or someone who wants to do something about this, what would you say to them?
I think with issues like this, it's very important to look at it from the perspective of equality. And all over the world, there is a lot of debate about reducing the inequality gap. Some people call that poverty, reducing the poverty gap. The definition of poverty, according to the Special Rapporteur on Poverty, now includes ability to access basic rights. So what that means in layman's terms is that if I am not able to access my rights, if I'm not able to access education, if I'm not able to access my right to work, I am in a state of poverty. And we Malaysians have the capacity to do something about that. There shouldn't be people living in poverty in Malaysia, especially when we know that there is a demand and a need for labor. We know that we don't want to live in a society where children who are fully capable of going to school are not able to go to school. We can make a difference for that. What we want for others, what we want for ourselves. And it would just be, the word I'm looking for is hypocritical, to not want those things for others who are in our very community. So I would say that thinking of others in our communities who in one way or other are going to have some kind of effect on the quality of our own well-being is probably the most proactive way to look at it.
Thank you very much again for taking the time to speak to me today.
Thank you, Chua. It was really good speaking to you too.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.